This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I have the great pleasure of talking to Robert Greenfield about his book, Bear, The Life and Times of Augustus Owsley Stanley III. How are you, Robert?
I'm well, thank you.
I really enjoyed this book. I think, you know, partly it might be an age thing or an era thing that I was there and lived through this, the period of time during which Owsley was so famous and culturally important. But there's so much more to his life than I realized. I'm really grateful to you for writing this book.
Well, I must tell you what has astonished me. My recent book appearances, signings, and readings is the degree to which LSD seems to be back in our culture. And, you know, I've got a bunch of 23-year-olds coming and asking me about microdosing and all these things I really don't know that much about. But I have been astonished at the reaction to this book. And I never thought that this many people would be interested in Bear. He did have, as you've already said, an extraordinary life. He was an extraordinary figure. I mean, if you want, we could just start talking about the family background, which is what knocked me out when I started doing the book.
Yeah, I think you should. I've got a whole bunch of questions for you, but I think you should talk about, you know, kind of the background that I think almost no one who reads this will know about at all.
Well, John Perry Barlow, who has written the lyrics to 30 Grateful Dead songs and co-founded the Electronic Frontier Foundation, says in the book of Bear, he was as American as apple pie. And that is one of the themes in the book. Bear's father, I'll call him Bear, although he was also known as Owsley. Bear's grandfather, Augustus Owsley Stanley, served three terms in the House of Representatives from the state of Kentucky. He was then elected as the governor of Kentucky. He then became the senator from Kentucky. He was being mentioned as a potential Democratic candidate for president after Woodrow Wilson. And he was an astonishing human being by all accounts. He was a trust-busting Democrat. He eventually was defeated in his reelection bid for the Senate because he opposed prohibition, which you would think is kind of crazy in a state that's known for making bourbon, right? But my favorite story about the grandfather, Bear adored the grandfather, who was a brilliant, well-read, incredibly educated human being. Politics was like a blood sport in Kentucky, and Augustus Owsley Stanley was running, I believe, for his first term in Congress, and he and his opponent would appear day after day at these rallies, and you have to think about it back then, probably no microphone, no public address system. Probably only men were attending these rallies. And they got to be very friendly and hung out a lot together. And so one day after his opponent had spoken, Augustus Owsley Stanley stepped to the front of the stage. And he had obviously had probably far too much to drink. And he turned around and he threw up. He threw up on stage. And then he came back to the front of the stage and said, "You must excuse me. Every time I hear my opponent speak, it makes me sick to my stomach."
That's a great story.
Very elegant mind. Now, Bear's father, Augustus Owsley Stanley Jr., seems to have been, you know, kind of overshadowed by his own father. He grew up in Washington, D.C. But at the age of 37, long after he would have been eligible for the draft, he chose to enlist in the Navy during World War II. He was serving as a lieutenant on the USS Lexington, which was in the Battle of the Coral Sea, which is the only naval battle in history where the ships never saw one another. The Lexington was destroyed. It was bombed into ruin, and it sank beneath him. Hundreds of seamen died. He survived, came back to Washington, became a lifelong alcoholic who spent his entire career working as a lawyer in the Small Business Administration. So Bear came from this kind of very impressive background. He was an extraordinarily gifted child. He taught himself how to read at the age of 3.5. For years, he didn't know how to use a dictionary because he saw letters as pictures. He had a kind of mind that I don't think I understand, even having written about him. He was a very difficult child. His parents divorced, and he went with his mother to Los Angeles. She could not tolerate, she couldn't handle him, basically. She sent him back to live with his father and stepmother. The father couldn't deal with him either. He sent him to a very prestigious military academy called Charlotte Hall. That's where he acquired his nickname, Bear, because his chest was hairy, and I assume nobody else's was. He was 13 years old, and one weekend he got everybody at the school drunk, and they threw him out. So that was the end of that. And then I'll go this far in his childhood, kind of. He then attended briefly the high school where both Shirley MacLaine and her brother Warren Beatty went. And he became, and I would think that the father offered him this as a deal to get him out of the house, he became a voluntary patient at St. Elizabeth's, which is a mental institution.
Where Ezra Pound was.
Where Ezra Pound, the poet, was then also confined. For those who may not know, Pound made anti-American, violently anti-American, and violently anti-Semitic statements in Italy during World War II. He was brought back to America, and they were going to put him on trial, but instead decided that he would be committed. He would be deemed to have been, quote-unquote, crazy, as opposed to have been a traitor. He spent 7 years in St. Elizabeth's, and when he emerged, someone asked him his opinion of his native-born country, and Pound said, "All America is a lunatic asylum." And that's also what this book is about.
It is true. Well, Bear, he has this extraordinary youth, and as you go on to point out that he ended up going to college and I think University of Virginia for one year.
Right.
But he had problems with authority. He was too smart for school. You know, he's kind of not really classic, but certainly a recognizable form of kind of genius who can't fit in with the expectations of a standard societal norm.
Classic oddball, classic misfit. But listen, as you know, and the people I've written about, Bill Graham, Jerry Garcia, Timothy Leary, these are the people who in many ways helped create the counterculture. And none of them were able to find a place that they belonged in conventional society. I don't think anybody who was not alive during that time can really understand how confining, how restrictive, how limited, you were supposed to just work your whole life and get that little house and then retire. And, they didn't see it. There was no path for them in that world. And each one of them in their own way created their own very American life.
Well, what's so interesting, too, having been around at that time, although kind of on the, I was a little, certainly younger than Owsley, but, the amazing congruency that got them all in the same place at the same time. That's it's hard to explain or even understand how Owsley ends up with the Grateful Dead.
Well, your point is well taken, but what people don't understand is how much smaller it was then. A, the world, and B, those who are coming together to create another world. It's no accident that once Owsley starts making the acid, the great acid, the purest acid ever synthesized on the street, he immediately meets Kesey and the Pranksters, and he's the guy who's supplying the LSD at the acid test. And then he's the guy who supplies the LSD at the human being. He's the guy who supplies the LSD at Monterey Pop. He's the guy whose LSD gets shipped from Monterey Pop to England, where John Lennon is terrified that he's going to run out of acid and will no longer be able to write brilliant music. And he wants to lay in a lifetime supply of Owsley's acid. The acid gets to Lennon. The Beatles trip constantly for the next 3.5 weeks. And then they make Magical Mystery Tour. So the fact that one man, through the power of chemistry, the miracle of chemistry, was able to exert his influence really throughout the world, It is extraordinary even now.
Well, and one thing you also mentioned, which I thought was important, was Owsley's spirituality, his connection to hermeticism and alchemy. You know, the right. He got a hold of the Kybalion pretty early on.
Right. I wouldn't call it spirituality. I mean, it's interesting. I don't think he was spiritual. He was very anti-religious, very anti-preacher, very anti any kind of organized spirituality. But he found in the Kybalion and in Hermetic philosophy, as above, so below, that everything he'd experienced on LSD could be understood in those terms. I mean, as he said to me, alchemy was never about turning lead into gold. That's what the church made it into during the Middle Ages. It was about the transformation of human beings. And that's what he was into with the acid. Yes, he made a lot of money from it because he made a lot of it. He also gave away half of what he made. He saw it as a way to help create this community of people who were looking to experience something that would help them transform themselves.
Do you think he felt, you know, that, you know, there's this kind of common wisdom now about the kind of arc of the, let's call, I mean, I hate to even call it the hippie movement, but the kind of loosely called counterculture, you know, particularly West Coast, San Francisco, in that arc, you know, there's a kind of rise and fall that we right. see. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think it's kind of an ex post facto application of a kind of narrative that may not have been lived or felt by the people that were living it. So my question is kind of a leading question. Do you agree with that? Do you feel like, you know, that what was going on with Owsley had, you know, or how did it connect to the overall narrative of what was going on in the counterculture?
Well, he absolutely fueled the culture through the acid and through first Kesey and the Pranksters, and then, you know, all the other iconic events. I mean, just peripherally, this was I don't know if the only guy. Bear was on stage at both Woodstock and Altamont doing sound. So he's everywhere. He's like completely Zelig in the heyday, you know, as the culture is exploding, as it's becoming, you know, spread through America, no longer just in the Bay Area, you know. But he occupied a unique position at that point. Rock Scully, who was the manager, he brought Rock Scully in to manage the Grateful Dead after giving him DMT to smoke, which is the way Bear often said hello to people. Here, take this, you know, and then let's see what happens. But, you know, Rock Scully said he was our good wizard. And part of the power of Owsley in that period was that he refused to have his photograph taken, in part because he knew the feds were already looking for him. They were going through his garbage in L.A. in 1966, you know. So he was avoiding being busted. But his reluctance to present a public face, unlike Garcia and many of the others in that era, gave him an aura of power that was overwhelming. You know what I mean? He just occupied this. There was no internet, okay? And people talked about him, and myths were created about him that made him far more powerful than whatever effect even his own LSD created in people. I mean, the thing to remember is that there were other acid chemists in the Haight. None of them were as skilled as Owsley. And there were other sources of LSD, but Owsley was like the high priest. And somehow his influence did push the counterculture to its heights. And then, yes, I lived through it. It went to, you know, it went to hell in a bucket, to quote the Grateful Dead. It totally fell apart. It went into disarray. People died, you know, leading figures in the culture died. And what I've found now is that it's never disappeared. It's always been there. It's underground. Now it's coming back. And what's crazy to me is that since the election, people are looking at this book as kind of a political statement. And all I can say is, yes, this is America too. You know, you can't put the lid back on the box once it's open. And all of these themes and threads are still in America now.
Well, that's true. And in fact, the common, the three themes, sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Never goes away.
Right. But it's culture that drives political action as well. It's, you know, there's that whole, what Owsley and the music and the drugs were about was freeing people to live their lives in, as you indicate, you know, in a transformed way, but that has political ramifications as well.
So here's the brilliance of Owsley, because he was so obsessive and so difficult and so one-pointed and so hard to deal with that people thought, well, he's not paying attention to anything but himself. But his insight into other people, I interviewed him for my Jerry Garcia book, I interviewed him for my Timothy Leary book, I interviewed him for my Bill Graham book. And the things he said about those people were so astonishingly brilliant. That's how I eventually came to, you know, write a profile for him about him for Rolling Stone and then to do this book. But he said something to me that I thought was astonishing, which relates to exactly what you just said, which is he said, you know, in the beginning, the shows were a dance concert. They were celebrations. The band often was playing in darkness. If there was a light show, great. People were not looking at the band. They were tripping and experiencing the music and celebrating one another. And then, as Owsley said, once it costs more than a movie to get in, people started watching the band. Mm. And every stroke of the lead guitarist's hands, Garcia, this is what they were fixated on. They stopped dancing. They stood there. They became spectators. And that also is the essence of America, which is it became spectacle as opposed to experience.
Right. And in a sense, the experience became commoditized.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, what I always tell people who can't imagine this is that when Jimi Hendrix played the Fillmore West for the first time, or when he played Fillmore East in New York for the first time, and whatever the capacities were, if it was the original Fillmore in San Francisco, there were only 800 people who wanted to see him.
Right.
He played the Fillmore East. He played two shows. Well, there were only 1,200 a show. That was the size of the... Okay, then think about Woodstock. Now, all of a sudden, you got 500,000. So, when it gets bigger, when it explodes, when the money comes in, everything's changed.
Right, which is exactly what happened and causes, you know, if you want to look at it as the, you know, that's where the downfall occurs. I mean, I think in a way that happened to the Grateful Dead too. I mean, one of the things I think that I kind of had forgotten the key role that Owsley played with the Dead at the very, very beginning, which,
oh, yeah,
you know, I'd read about years ago and kind of just filed away. But, you know, he was there. He was a brilliant sound engineer, sound theorist, which I think is another part of his life that, you know, probably you have revealed more than anybody else has known.
Well, it is true. And it's even beyond that, which is he bought them all their equipment because he was the only one who had money. These guys were broke. The Dead didn't have any money. They weren't paid to work at the acid test. All of them were getting $125 for a show in San Francisco. They were broke. He bought them all their equipment. They wanted to go to L.A. to follow the acid test. He bankrolled them. He kept them alive in L.A. They came back to San Francisco. There was kind of an initial parting of the ways. They gave him back all. He bought them more new equipment. And as everybody, Bob Weir said this, and Phil Lesh, who Bear was closest to in the band, I mean, his obsessive need to record every show for no reason other than to allow him to listen to what they had sounded like through the PA and in the hall. He called it a sonic diary. He got them to start listening to the way they had sounded. And his insistence, his pursuit of excellence was so intense, and his influence on them at that point was so strong, he made them so much better as a band. Aside from all the... none of these shows would be, you know, you wouldn't be able to hear any of this music had he not been recording it on a very high quality tape recorder, you know, from the board as he did sound during these early shows.
I know that is an amazing thing. How many, I think you quoted the number of shows that he recorded.
So many, so many. But you know what? I've done this in my readings, and if you'll allow me, you know, I've been asked, like, Bob, why do you quote people so much? And the reason I quote people so much is that they're usually smarter than I am, and they're saying something that I'm not capable of saying. So here is what Jerry Garcia said about Owsley. Quote, "He's got enough of every kind of experience, man. There's almost nothing the guy hasn't done. You know, he's a licensed blacksmith. Not only that, but he's got a first-class broadcaster's license, too. He worked for years in TV. He's also an excellent auto mechanic. He's obviously a chemist. There's almost nothing he doesn't do, or at least have a good grasp of. He understands just about every level of organization. He's just incredible. He's got some incredible capacity for retaining information." So Garcia says this while Bear is doing 2 years of a three-year bit in federal prison, okay? And the insanity of all of this is that while Bear is at Terminal Island, the dead come there and play a show for Bear. And none of them get searched. The road cases don't get searched. God knows what they bring into the prison. I mean, these are things you cannot make up, okay?
Probably could never happen today either.
Would never happen today. That's exactly right. To allow the Grateful Dead into a prison where the guy who gave them their acid is serving time, it's just... But this was his life. This was, and after he came out, he never made acid again. He had a lot of stuff stashed in various places, but he then, you know, went back to work for the Dead. He did sound. Everything had changed. Your point is well taken here. The road crews, it had become show business. These guys were drinking beer and snorting cocaine. It wasn't the way it was. They didn't want to listen to Bear. He couldn't deal with them. And, you know, when the Dead go on hiatus, that's pretty much about it for Bear as their sound man. He still always remains a member of the extended Grateful Dead family. When they play in Egypt, he's there. He continues even recording shows after, you know, he goes out on the road and actually records Old and In the Way. Jerry Garcia playing bluegrass with David Grisman, you know, a great band. He remains around the Dead, and then I'm moving forward here, but then he gets possessed with the fact that the Ice Age storm, the biblical storm of Noah, 40 days and 40 nights, is coming. And the entire northern hemisphere is going to be subsumed by 40 feet of water, waves the size of buildings. And he emigrates to Australia, where he squats on 126 acres of land in the middle of nowhere, and builds a compound that is like something out of a science fiction movie. You know, shipping canisters and living spaces with no walls and wind generators and hot tubs and, you know, vessels to collect rainwater. He's completely off the grid on every level imaginable, gets very involved in the internet, and then periodically, a couple times a year, comes back to America, goes on tour with the Dead to sell his jewelry, which at this point he is a certified Grateful Dead legend. And all these nouveau deadheads, I mean, don't they want a belt buckle of the Steely that Owsley created? They do.
So that's how he made his living.
And the royalties from the re-release of all the live tracks. Yes, that's how he survived. And you know, he dies at the age of 72. He leans over while he's driving home in a rainstorm. Miles Davis is on the radio. He leans over to turn up the radio, and his car slams into a tree, and he dies.
And he had cancer at that point, right?
He had suffered terribly. He was the cancer was one thing, thyroid cancer, but he was over-radiated. And a lot of people in that era were. They didn't know how much was too much, and it really debilitated him physically. He couldn't eat solid food, but he was still, you know, Bear. He flew around the world with a card stating that he was a cancer victim and therefore could bring all kinds of, you know, stuff on a plane that no one else could. He flew around the world with weed that he had grown in Australia. You know, he was beyond the law. That's the best way I can describe it.
Well, I almost, well, as you just, you know, when you called him a wizard, or when actually the dead called him a wizard, I mean, there is something to that, that he carried that kind of elemental power that made him almost superhuman, or human in a different level of reality.
Yeah, you know, and again, I can't argue, and, you know, one cannot possibly, you know, talk about everything that's in a book, but, you know, one point, I'm going back now, in 1958, he goes to see the Bolshoi Ballet, first time they've ever been in America. It begins the ballet revolution in America, and he's so taken with the lead dancer that he goes back to speak to him, and the lead dancer doesn't speak English. Bear then becomes fluent in Russian and starts taking two ballet classes a day at the age of like 26 or 28, long after you becomes pretty adept at ballet. But, I mean, that's the level of the brain. And right. Again, the way he got into all of this, he had taken acid and had a trip. Then somebody gave him half a cap of Sandoz, which is Sandoz Pharmaceuticals in Basel, Switzerland, where Albert Hofmann first synthesized LSD in 1938, looking for a respiratory and circulatory stimulant, and then left it alone. 5 years later, he started working with it again, research. He accidentally ingested some, had an LSD experience, and then 3 days later took the first intentional acid trip in history. It's now known as Bicycle Day, because he got on his bicycle and rode home. 250 milligrams of LSD. Okay, so Bear takes half a cap of the real stuff. He realizes he's never experienced LSD before. He then goes to the Bancroft Library at the University of California, Berkeley, and he spends a week or two with his girlfriend, who is studying to become a research chemist at Berkeley, and he teaches himself how to make LSD. And with all due respect to Walter White, this is not like cooking meth in the kitchen, blowing up the house, and then going to find another house. It's an incredibly complicated process. It's incredibly difficult. LSD is very fragile. It's very hard. It dissolves in water. It's subject to temperature changes. Years later, John Perry Barlow is at a conference. He meets Albert Hofmann. He says to Albert Hofmann, "By any chance, are you familiar with my friend Owsley?" And Hofmann says, "Oh, yes, I am." And then he tells Barlow, "I have seen many variations, many formulations of LSD, but your friend is the only one who ever got the crystallization process correct." How can you understand this from sitting in a library?
Well, no, there's so many things that, you know, you could almost, like, you, the other thing I felt we had to talk about is the Grateful Dead logo, which, you know, there's another thing that he's responsible for that's basically a ubiquitous piece of American culture.
He's driving in one day to the warehouse in Novato, where the Dead keep their stuff and rehearse and all this. And he sees like this weird image on a building off the side of the freeway. At this point, the Dead are playing huge concerts, and their gear, all their road boxes, are backstage with everybody else's gear. And it drives Bear crazy that he can't find their gear as quickly as he wants to. And he says to his friend, who's an artist, "Hey, man, what if we did this thing and you sprayed it in half with the thing, with the lightning bolt, blah, blah," and they do a couple versions of it, and they create the Steely, and then the friend sells it to the Grateful Dead as a letterhead for $200. Now, I would tell you that along with the tongue, the Rolling Stones tongue, that is absolutely the most iconic logo in rock.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It would have been worth a fortune if they had copyrighted it. Okay.
But that's, you know, that's kind of the mythology, you know, that's, I love that stuff. I also, I think, you know, you mentioned his interest in war and in weather, but it's really an interest in, and an understanding that global warming, global climate change is actually happening. And he was recognizing this, you know, 35 years ago. So, you know,
but it's not global warming. He didn't believe in global warming. This is something else completely, which I've tried to explain it in the book, but I'm not sure I got it. You know what I mean? It does have to do with ice melting, but Bear could go to places. I mean, one of the great quotes is that Bob Weir, you know, met Owsley while he was on Owsley acid way back and said to me, you know, if you were going to talk to Bear back then, you had to pack a lunch. He didn't make anything quick. He could talk, you know?
Well, yeah, I think that's part of the persona, for sure.
Part of the brain. It was part of the brain. You know what I mean? He gave no cognizance to the normal rules of human behavior. They did not apply to him. They never did. You know, he was out there before he ever took acid. And, you know, as I said about these people who formed the culture, they brought so much with them before they ever experienced psychedelics that it only made them bigger.
Mm.
Certainly Garcia. I mean, Garcia's brain, well, as Garcia famously said of Owsley, there's nothing wrong with Bear that a few billion less brain cells wouldn't cure.
Yeah, that was a great quote.
It is a great one.
It certainly sums him up. Well, what about his kids? You know, he had, you talked about two of the four kids a little bit, but what are his kids like?
Well, he had two children with two different women during his oddball misfit period. And, you know, one of them didn't turn out so well. Bear tried to deal with him as an adult. The other one was a daughter who never knew that Bear was her father. But then he had two children who are named Starfinder and Redbird. And Redbird lives in Australia. Starfinder lives in California. And they had a real relationship with him. As everybody who knew him was cognizant of this, as Bear got older, he got sweeter. He got easier to deal with. He was still Bear. I mean, you know, at his daughter's wedding on his property, he got obsessed with the amplifiers, and somebody had to say to him, Bear, your daughter's getting married here. Can you stop fucking with the,
That's all right.
Stop fussing with the amps. So while he could never change his basic personality, you know, Barlow once said about him, you know, I pretty much always know what Bear's going to say, but I listen to it anyway. And that's what it was like, you know?
Well, it's really, it was a wonderful book. I really enjoyed it. And you've done it great service in talking to me today.
So my pleasure.
I appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you, Robert Greenfield.
Thank you.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Robert Greenfield about his book, Bear, The Life and Times of Augustus Owsley Stanley III, and I really recommend it.